Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA. It doesn't seem that it was only October when Ireland's Great Hunger Museum officially opened in Hamden, Connecticut. But it was only that short few months ago. And indeed, as we have been telling you before, during, and after, it is now the home of the world's largest collection of visual art, artifacts, printed material relating to the Irish famine, located on Whitney Avenue, near the University of Mount Carmel and York Hill campuses of Quinnipiac University. I'd like to welcome, first of all, Grace Brady, who is the executive director of Ireland's Great Hunger Museum. And Grace, you're very welcome.
Thanks very much for having me.
What brought you to Connecticut? We thought that you were, unless this is a typo, you were born in the Metropolitan Museum of Art, having spent...
That's a typo. I was at the Metropolitan Museum of Art for 23 years.
23 years?
But I was not born there.
Oh, okay.
But thank you for thinking that.
And you're not short of Irish lineage, indeed?
No, Irish through and through. My maternal grandparents emigrated from Ireland, and they came from Cavan and Cork. And then my... paternal great-grandparents came from Cavan and Clare.
Oh, how about that? Okay. Well, now we have a true dub in the house, as well in the person of Niamh O'Sullivan, who is the inaugural curator of Ireland's Great Hunger Museum at Quinnipiac University, a professor emeritus of visual culture at the National College of Art and Design in Dublin, Ireland, wearing two hats and a lot of mileage credits.
A lot of miles in between, you're absolutely
a lot of
right.
Miles. Both of you are very welcome. I'd like to start, Niamh, in perhaps you're giving us an idea, perhaps your own reaction to an assignment of John Leahy, who of course is president of Quinnipiac University, and following through on an idea and a notion that the United States of America actually did not have a museum dedicated to the Great Irish Hunger, a museum on Gortha Moor, and that, ironically, that this was fact. He wanted to pursue an idea that was extraordinary, and I just kind of wonder if you might be able to tell us about the assignment and what your own reaction was, this crazy yank.
I suppose just over a year ago, President John Leahy asked me to come over to assess a collection that he had been amassing for about 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
To assess the strengths and weaknesses with a view to opening the museum in September, which I thought was absolutely impossible at the time. But when John Leahy wants to do something,
right,
it happens. So we worked incredibly hard. There were gaps in the collection, and he was very enthusiastic to fill them and facilitated almost every suggestion that I made. So we found some terrific art to add to the very interesting
right
art that he had already collected over that period of time.
Tell us about the art that he had already collected and the display and where that was.
There were a lot of sculptures, work by John Behan, and a number of American sculptors, Meg Chamberlain, mm-hmm. Glenna Goodacre, Robert Schur, with an emphasis on maquettes for a lot of the national and famine monuments in America and in Ireland. We have the maquette to the National Famine Memorial in Ireland, which was executed by John Behan, and several others. So there were quite a number of pieces of sculpture and quite a number of paintings that were painted since the 150th anniversary in 1995. Mm-hmm. So, and a number of other interesting pieces as well. But trying to cover the period from the famine itself mm-hmm. right up to the present day, there were obvious gaps. Now, some of those gaps are almost unfillable because there was very little art produced around the time of the famine. It was not a subject that people wanted to buy right. and hang on their walls. You don't want dying, emaciated, hungry bodies, funerals, scenes mm-hmm. of emigration. So it's a kind of subject matter that artists shied away from unless they told the story allegorically. So mm. there were a number of those kind of paintings. So there were long gaps. And the way we tried to fill those was by using contemporary illustrations, because the foundation of illustrated newspapers like the Illustrated London News and Punch yeah. and so on coincided actually with the famine in the 1840s. So we found extraordinarily powerful images that did tell the story very graphically, the death, the disease, the emigration, the evictions, the workhouse and so on. Mm-hmm. So we've made quite a feature of those in the museum. And then in more recent times, we've managed to acquire some really quite stunning art by Irish artists with an international reputation, people mm-hmm. like Brian Maguire and Alan O'Kelly, Robert right. Balla, and so on. So we now do span the period from the 1840s right up to the present. And even as we continue, there is more to be found, because yeah. we're focusing on the famine and its aftermath, because of course 1 million people died during the famine.
Right.
1 million emigrated, but a further 2 million emigrated subsequently. And the poverty and the lack of confidence and the damage to the language and to the identity of the Irish continued long past the actual period of the famine itself.
Mm-hmm. Also, I think that many of us would remember that singularly you would have someone of the caliber of John Leahy, president of Quinnipiac University, who was not accepting of the popular opinion in the United States that a plague happened and that there was no blame. There was that happens and continues to happen, and as such, history was becoming very accepting of the famine as a plague, as a disaster, as a natural disaster. Mm-hmm. And indeed, much to the chagrin of a great number of, well, not only British, but in the field of education and historians, were possibly waiting for a voice, somebody who brought credibility to the reality. Yes, yes, there was blame. Mm. And remember that, you know, that this was not just somebody, an author or a historian. This was somebody who was putting his reputation on the line and say, hey, the plague itself was unavoidable, but the reaction to it was actually worse.
Yes, yes.
That's true.
I mean, we know that food was shipped out of the country
right.
while people were dying. We know that rapacious landlords were evicting tenants who had no money, no food, mm-hmm. And that, you know, there was an interest in land clearance to a certain extent. So the degree to which the neglect, to put it at its most benign, the degree to which the neglect was allowed to continue is simply shocking. So it was. It did take the vision of somebody like John Leahy to address that.
Right. I want to ask you, Grace, about actually your own undertaking. You know, as executive director, coming from the Metropolitan Museum of Art here in New York City, where was there some degree of reality for you that you were talking about a place that is ideally situated between, you know, almost equidistant from Boston and from New York, but up in Connecticut, in an area that most people didn't know about or sounded quite scary, so that they, in undertaking, you know, the directorship of this, it was like light years away from what you had been.
There's obviously it's very different, and I loved working at the Met. It's a wonderful institution. That sort of goes without saying, and I had been there a long time, and for me it was always, if I was going to leave, it had to be something unique, specific, important to me, and professionally a good move for me. And when I saw this position posted, it said Ireland's Great Hunger Museum, I thought, this is so interesting and different, and what are they doing? And so I figured, well, I'll throw my hat in the ring, and I sent my resume and spoke with the headhunter, and initially it didn't really go anywhere. The headhunter said, you know, maybe this is not a match or whatever. I said, well, if they're interested in speaking with me, I'd love to, and I did. And once I spoke with John Leahy, I mean, anyone who speaks to him about this, the passion and the enthusiasm and the you know, the excitement about getting
the commitment
commitment to do it, and having an Irish background, that was you know, obviously a personal connection for me, and I always like to think now that my grandparents are smiling down on me for taking this on. And it's exciting. There's challenges. It's a smaller institution, clearly, but a lot of the policies and issues that museums in general face are something that I've been trained in and feel like I can, you know, address here. And so I'm excited. It's learning a lot every day, and particularly about the Irish culture, and working with Niamh has been a dream, and learning a lot from her and from Christine Keneally, who's the historian on this. So there's a lot of possibilities, and day to day we're trying to move them along.
Relatively new. You're only talking about a few months, and obviously the word hasn't spread to where, if we could fast forward for another year, a couple of years, this will be, you know, the center of an amazing museum, and one which, incidentally, has been extraordinarily well reviewed. We could, among other, New York Times, and in January, the beginning of the year.
Sylvie-Anne Gold reviewed the museum, and we're more than thrilled with it. I spoke with her briefly while she was there, and she was personally moved by the story, and felt very strongly about it, and we're just thrilled with the review. And we hear people say, oh, I read it in the Times, and that's why we're here. So
also, I think the headline is very catching, in the sense that it says mournful, angry views of Ireland's famine, because that really says it.
Yes.
That's very,
that's
very
right.
Accurate. Niamh O'Sullivan, let me ask you, when nobody asked you, and I'm sure the ideal circumstances would have been as the inaugural curator, that you would start from scratch and work your way into it. Now, there was an established collection
yes.
already. Most of it, as you have pointed out, most of it artifacts and sculptures and whatever. What challenge did that pose to you in saying, boy, you know, I have a cartload of stuff here that already is, you know, very much a part of the history. Here's John Leahy had now rolled out mm-hmm. what was up until became his own competitor in the opening of the museum mm-hmm. because it was a lot of the artwork. Mm-hmm. How do you go about that? And how does that? What kind of challenge is that for?
Well, I suppose the starting point is assessing the strengths and weaknesses and the gaps. And I discussed with John Leahy the criteria that we might use in going forward. So we would say that the work must be of museum quality.
Mm.
It must be executed by an artist of national or international standing. And that we should be in time broadening out to artists of the diaspora.
Mm-hmm.
So following the story, not only from Ireland, but to America as well, because a number of artists were actually emigres of the famine themselves, artists
right.
like William Michael Harnett and Thomas Hovenden and John Mulvaney and so on
right.
Had actually left Ireland at the time of the famine and come to America. So the story can be picked up there as well. And that is something that we have been discussing over the last week, that we
yeah.
might continue
right.
developing that.
How do you weave art? There's a procurement phase. There is something. How do you weave that into the stories.
The story, yes. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that we were very fortunate in the pieces that we were able to find in a very short time. So we have an extraordinary painting, for example, the one by Michael Farrell, Black 47.
Right.
And so the theme was just perfect. And Michael Farrell is an artist of huge personality and I think many would say anger himself, and he felt incredibly passionately about the subject, and he did a whole series of paintings. And then when he died, the paintings went into abeyance almost. They disappeared
right.
from sight. So finding those was a matter of great
yeah.
fortune. Now, what was really quite unique was at the same time the building was being built, because when I arrived over, it was a shell. There was
right.
no floors in the building even. So as we acquired interesting and individual artwork, we were able to adapt architectural features and design features of the museum
right.
to match the artwork. So the huge Michael Farrell painting, I think it's about 15 feet
uh-huh.
wide, we built a wall jutting into the museum.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a light shaft that shines down. It's a courtroom. And Trevelyan is on trial for his act in the
right.
in the famine. And there's a shaft of light coming down, a kind of cinematic shaft of light. We were able to position it against the window to increase the sense of kind of veracity. So we were able to do a lot of work building the museum around the artwork.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that gives it considerable immediacy and intensifies the emotional effect
yeah,
of the work.
That's very dramatic, that piece. And being able to do that instead of putting it in an already existing structure
right.
makes it that much more dramatic and effective.
However, as you go forward,
mm-hmm.
And this is the, again, for those of us who have been who have not only visited but who have been astounded at the rollout of this, one would have to wonder what happens when you come across a treasure trove, because one thing that the President John Leahy has is committed to is identifying and then acquiring a lot of the art that perhaps was not considered to be of commercial value. I think probably one of the reasons that this art, particularly the older art, is around, is that it didn't have the commercial appeal at the time, and there is a load of it, isn't there?
Yes, I think that's true to some extent. But I think around 1995, things changed considerably with the 150th anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to that, even the centenary in 1945, there was nothing. There was mm-hmm. nothing done.
Yeah.
And when the government thought about doing something, they waited a year to 1946, and then they had a Thomas Davis exhibition in memory of the famine. So they weren't
right.
even prepared
yeah.
to look at that subject at that time. So no artists were dealing with that subject at that time. But with the 150th anniversary, I think for the first time people began to talk about the legacy of the famine and the great silence that had followed it, and the fact that there was very little literature, very little painting. And that seemed to have awakened the interest of a lot of artists who began to then turn to it as subject matter.
Right. Grace Brady, is this peculiar to the Irish? Do you see a pattern that in the areas of hunger and famine, that there is a sense of either shame, mm-hmm. The inherited guilt, mm-hmm. the survivor syndrome,
sure.
that leaves huge gaps? Is that, are we better at it than others, or in your own experience with the Met?
Well, I think there's definitely all of those things surrounding this subject, shame and guilt, and one interesting thing that I learned early on in this position, there was the artist panel, and the artists all spoke, and they all said that this museum would not happen in Ireland, or mm-hmm. they're not ready for it yet, if ever.
Right.
And that said volumes to me, that it is, in some ways, this museum, it is bold of John Leahy,
right.
It is important. In some ways, this museum, because it is so specific, but it will grow in other areas, you know, with the diaspora, you know, we can extend things. It's as if it's like a gallery within an exhibition within a larger encyclopedic museum. But that's not to say that there are not possibilities mm-hmm. of things we can do when we acquire new things and we rotate the collection and bring mm-hmm. new exhibitions in and hopefully send this one out.
Right.
I don't think it's a limitation or
okay.
anything like that. I think, you know, there's just different possibilities.
Niamh O'Sullivan, let me ask you about, because you made earlier reference to collections of drawings, of prints, of imprints. You can tell I'm way up in the lingo here.
the illustrations. Yeah.
Illustrations.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of them, again, dating back, when you talk about Punch, and when you talk about a lot of the British publications, most of those were not complimentary.
Well, it's interesting. Punch, you're absolutely right. So this is the typical simianized image of the Irish as an ape. And, mm-hmm. you know, contemporary...
And the leprechaun and the everything
yeah.
else. And
yeah.
the drunk and the...
Lazy
yeah.
And,
yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And, I mean, contemporary theory even argued that they used a theory of phrenology, and they argued that the Irish were the missing link. But not all of them were caricatures, and journals like the Illustrated London News did treat the subject matter seriously. But there is still a difference between whether the artist or the illustrator was British or Irish. And not surprisingly, if you have an Irish illustrator like James Mahoney
right.
from Cork, who's working in London at the heart of the empire, nonetheless, when he went to Cork And he did a whole series of illustrations over several weeks based on his visit. You get a much more sympathetic and an angrier view, actually, of what was happening. So he shows the funerals and the fact that people were being buried without a coffin, without a shroud. They were being buried without the rites of the church. Mm-hmm. They were being buried without the traditional wake. So all of those things would have been a matter of considerable anger and distress to somebody like Mahony, as opposed to an English illustrator who would have been at least more dispassionate, if not more critical. So there you might find the Irish being characterised as, you know, dirty and a little right. bit savage, a little bit, well, maybe not savage, but certainly a little bit primitive. Mm-hmm. And there would be a lot of focus on the shortcomings of the Irish character. So
which would have been backed up if we look at the what the imagery was, and again,
indeed, you know. because the poverty was unspeakable. I mean, if you read right. the descriptions, Frederick Douglass, the great mm-hmm. abolitionist, visited Ireland in 1845, and his description of Irish poverty, he said, exceeded anything within his own experience as a slave. And that's a question extraordinary.
That says it all.
Doesn't it? Really does.
Yeah. Yeah.
What about the treasure trove again of, say, of art from a regional standpoint, like throughout Ireland? Is there a glut of it somewhere? Are the attics of Ireland
full of images of the famine? I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
Yeah.
But when you hit on, like, how do you go about even identifying what is?
Well, I suppose a number of art historical traditional research strategies, okay. looking up contemporary exhibition catalogues. So mm-hmm. what was being exhibited in the Royal Academy in London in the 1840s, what was being exhibited in the Royal Hibernian Academy in Dublin in the 1840s, and then seeing an odd subject, not many, but an odd subject like eviction or right. something like that, then you know that that artist was doing something. So, but, you know, by starting with those kind of means and trying to follow through, you will find a certain amount of work. And then it's also serendipity, you know, something mm-hmm. turns up at auction and it just happens to fit.
Right.
Or,
right. or how often does that happen? Realistically?
A lot.
Really?
Yeah.
It, more than you think.
Yeah. And if you're attuned to something, right. I always know if I'm researching an area and I'm really attuned to it, things start to jump out at you.
Really?
And then I suppose the third thing is that other people know you're working on it, and every now and then I'll get a phone call and somebody will say, oh, I think somebody has something. Or
right.
So it's a combination of all of those things. And I must say last year we were phenomenally lucky. We
yeah.
just found some of the, you know, the really strong, interesting, challenging art with big ideas behind them just yeah. happened to emerge when we were mm-hmm. when we were looking. And then, of course, the final point is you have to have somebody who's prepared, can and will pay.
Right.
So if you bring all of those things together, so the availability of the work and the receptivity of it, and then the capacity to purchase
so.
It. So all of those things did come together.
Right. Now, President Quinnipiac University, John Leahy, does credit in terms of what we can describe in hindsight as the finder, gives a lot of credit to Kenny's bookstore in Galway.
Indeed. And for the 15 years that they were collecting,
yeah.
Conor Kenny was John Leahy's partner in searching out all of that work.
Right.
And the wonderful John Behan pieces and a lot of the art that came through actually Kenny's gallery themselves.
Right.
They had many exhibitions from 1995 onwards, and that was the source of a lot of the art that was collected in the initial years by the university.
Let me ask you, Grace Brady, who is the executive director of Ireland's Great Hunger Museum in Hampden, Connecticut. Museums who have acquired over the years collections,
mm-hmm.
are they even approachable in terms of saying, you know, you have a piece there and we'd really like to have it? Is there a sense...
You mean for like an exchange or a loan?
Yeah, an exchange or a purchase or a whatever.
Generally, if a piece is in a museum, another museum, you wouldn't sell it to another museum.
Okay.
But exchanges are commonplace in the museum world. As long as the curator and the museum can justify why it's important that they need that piece for this particular exhibition or... you know, and why you would want to lend to another institution.
So that's fairly common.
And it strengthens both museums.
Right. How do you take, Niamh O'Sullivan, how do you take a museum such as Ireland's Great Hunger Museum, how do you take that on the road, as it were? Is that a phase that comes after years and years? How does it work?
Well, we've just been talking about that this week, actually.
Really?
And we are planning on bringing the exhibition to Ireland. We think in about 3 years' time.
Right.
We need time to bed the exhibition down here, work on the educational dimensions of it, the docent training, bringing in schools, and all of that. So we think probably we will leave the exhibition as it is for slightly longer than might be common elsewhere, because we do have to try and get people familiar with the idea that it is there to build its audience.
Yeah, it's definitely important that the inaugural exhibition, because it's the opening of a new museum, it's important to me, definitely, that it's there so people have the opportunity and time to come over and not feel like when they come it's the second exhibition and they missed the first thing.
But how do you weave that into it being a prime educational tool, as it were, and how do you get that process up and going?
I'd love anyone's advice on that. No, we're working on that. You going out to school groups. We actually had a meeting this week where we're at the head of the education department at Quinnipiac and speaking with different groups within the university and how we go about that. That's got to be our priority, is to get school groups in and also to outreach to
Is there a strategy in place that...
Not specifically, but that's we're going to work locally first and then branch out further than that.
But there isn't a circuit established as such.
Not specifically. And we're trying to get a grant to help us with creating those teachers' materials and have training for teachers. So it's all in the beginning stages, strategy-wise as well.
Right.
But it's priority for us is the education component.
And I might add, Grace, there are some international groups that are formed, scholarly communities that are working on research elements and so on of the famine. And Quinnipiac has already been invited to join a number of those.
Okay.
So we are already entering the community, the international community of famine scholarship. So we're delighted to have been welcomed in so early and look forward to contributing in terms of exhibition work and various databases that we're building and research facilities that we're developing.
A huge undertaking, though, right?
Yeah.
There are some untapped, I'm only guessing at this, philanthropists who actually have not even had an opportunity to support or become involved in something on this side of the Atlantic because it didn't exist before. Any room, as it were, like where and how do you make sure that we don't lose the interest of those who I'm sure would be shocked to even know of its existence here.
Well, it's a lot of work and marketing, and also, you know, I'm working on creating a membership program that would bring donors in, and it's work, but good work, and the university is definitely supportive of that and going out, and we do have to tap into a lot of, you know, Irish Americans who may not already know about it, and I think once they do, would be thrilled to. And I've had people say to me, do you have a donor program or membership program, and when you do, here's my name, and you know, so there's interest, but we need to sort of structure it and formally roll it out
and launch it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
What do you see your own role, Niamh, in the not too distant future? Like, what do you see for the next couple of years? What remains to be done? Is there who do you see, if you think, for instance, that there is an art piece that is there, and geez, we have to get past this Niamh one if we want to get it to another area. What's that process?
Well, I suppose there are many different separate strands that have to be developed over the next few years. So one is continuing to acquire appropriate artwork.
Right.
The other, as Grace said, is making friends and getting the money together, the donations in to help do that. And then the educational side, which is vitally important. So we have a number of, we think, quite exciting plans to develop the education and the outreach to it. So we have a big and very ambitious publications program. We're going to start with a series of pamphlets that are going to be stunningly well designed and feature new scholarship in the area, leading to a number of books. And we're also developing a number of interactive elements, because we feel that it's important that the museum is an exciting space curatorially.
Right.
So it's not just a niche.
Which is no small feat,
considering.
So there's
going to be a lot of work involved in developing that, so that the museum is, as a sort of mediatory space, is exciting, and, you know, children are going to want to come because they want to play with the interactive elements.
Right.
They want just a sense of learning themselves rather than just having to read the captions on the paintings, you know, a self-discovery element to the interactive programs. So a combination of all of those things we are working on simultaneously, and then a number of exhibitions. So we're talking about things like, I mean, there's no decision taken yet, but, you know, we might do an exhibition on the Irish in the Civil War, or a series of thematic exhibitions, maybe evictions.
Printed materials, another aspect, we're trying to slide over that, but actually you've got an amazing collection of printed materials. Some of them appear like they are there to stay, that they become part of the fabric of the museum itself.
Yes, and I think that's where, again, that's where Kenny's did such important work for the university. So the fact that the library has all the British parliamentary papers from the period, and a lot of important letters that tell of the social life of the period, and so on, that kind of ephemera, printed material and ephemera, is very important and will feed into what we see as the kind of the linchpin, which is the formation of a research institute, which will unite the work that's been done by the library, by the museum, and in the research capacity to kind of bring it all together.
Existing, what can we expect for somebody who may be thinking of, well, let's get up here, let's see this. Talk about the visual art, talk about the technology, some of the research that already exists. I mean, this is not a museum where you go in and have a quick look around and leave the car outside pouring.
No.
Let's hope not, yeah.
Yeah. But there is, it is... And again, I think you touched on it. It's got to be interesting to not only kids, but it has to be interesting across the board. And what in addition to the sculptures, the artwork, the paintings, all of that, what visual aids are there to in fact, reflect today's technology?
Well, initially downstairs, there's what we recommend everyone see first. There's a 13 to 14 minute orientation video that was produced by the Social House in Dublin.
Mm-hmm.
Did a fabulous job, and Neve also worked on that. And it's a real summary of visually of the famine period.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of gives you the opening to then look at the 19th century collection downstairs. And then upstairs, there's a beautiful illustration wall that's a video pulls the text out of some of the Illustrated London News and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's thematic on poverty and eviction. And again, Neve and worked on that as well. So there's those two pieces right now, but the hope is and the plan is to have more of an interactive piece as well, which will take some work,
right.
But we look forward to getting it up.
Neve, what is and has there been a change in the reaction of Irish people in Ireland to the subject of Ireland's greatest tragic period of history?
Well, I think the reaction to the museum has been very striking. The Irish Times did almost a full page. Lara Marlow did a wonderful article on it.
She did, yeah.
RTE, the arts show, then did an hour-long
right.
programme on Stephen's Day, followed by 4 hour-long programmes on the famine, which was sponsored by Quinnipiac University and
mm-hmm.
went out on the Irish Airways to huge acclaim. It was produced by Yeti Redmond, a very talented producer in RTE, and they were really well received, very well researched and very well received. So, and we just heard over the last couple of days that History Ireland, the magazine, has done a new review, which is very positive. So the
Irish American Magazine, obviously, as well.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Yeah. So
fabulous.
So big interest. Yeah.
Right. Acceptance, if a poll were taken, is there still some degree of resistance from, say, an older community that might have inherited some of the reluctance to even bring it up in the first place?
None yet that I'm aware of.
Yeah.
And the attendance at the museum, the large percentages, it's the older generation, which is what I expected because they're the ones who know it, and which
yeah.
is great. So one of my goals is to get the younger audience interested and to learn about it, and so that's all part of the education program and how we can get the middle schoolers and the high schoolers and the young adults there
right.
as well. So I love it when I see some parents bring their kids in, and it's very satisfying.
And I'm glad you mentioned that because it is. We spend a lot of time and people travel all over the world to come to New York City, which is the hub,
mm-hmm.
Of a culture and an awareness that if you come to New York City, get your walking shoes on and you'll trip over, all the as many museums as you'll be able to visit and absorb what goes on there.
Right.
This is, a first for the subject of the Irish famine.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it is devoted to very specifically the famine. I think it's terrific, but I think also that it is a place where you can actually drive to, plan on spending
Absolutely.
The day, and take the kids, because it's not, sometimes it conjures up an image of God, a museum.
Right.
What are we going to do with the kids?
Well, a few weeks ago, we actually had our first group of Girl Scouts in on a weekend, and we did my assistant Claire Tynan did a little program with them of a scavenger hunt and a story about the famine, a children's story. And so it was heartening to see that. You know, they may not understand it all, but it's right. to start educating at that level. It was you know, very nice to see, and hope to see more of.
Is there an element to creating an awareness that, as horrific and as tragic as the Irish famine was, that we don't have to go back to the mid-1840s to address a topic that, despite all of the progress that has been made worldwide, real hunger, starvation is indeed very much a part of today's world?
Yeah, sadly. Sadly it is. And several people have asked me when they come, do I have to be Irish to come to this museum? And I say, of course not. I said it's the Irish story, which has not been told fully and accurately, and that's why it's being done. But it's a human story, and famine exists in our world today, which is, you know, shocking to believe. But it really makes all of us have to look at ourselves and our governments and our individual contributions, and why is that happening today?
Absolutely. Okay. Obviously, we would again like to acknowledge the tremendous efforts of John Leahy in making this happen. I think it took a long time. It is there, and his commitment to make sure that this was not just something that ended with an opening, which was spectacular and which was amazing, that this is here to stay, and this is an amazing legacy. It really is. Mm. And I'll tell you, it's well worth seeing, and I think now that we're getting through the winter, and as we go on into, I think we're going to see a great push and an opportunity, because anybody who visits there will definitely be able to spread the word. That's where your ambassadors are going to come from.
Agree.
That's right.
Niamh O'Sullivan, the inaugural curator. You're never going to be able to get away from that. The curators come and go, but the inaugural.
She's going to be our consultant curator going forward, so still connected with us.
Absolutely. Just in case somebody says, wait a minute, how did this come about? They'd say, well, okay, you have to ask. Ireland's Great Hunger Museum at Quinnipiac University, indeed, Professor Emeritus of Visual Culture at National College of Arts and Design in Dublin, Ireland. Again, great to see you. And obviously, Grace.
Thanks, Adrian.
Grace Brady, you're not going anywhere.
No, I'm not.
You can't even get on a plane to go anywhere. But it is obviously. It's a huge challenge, but an amazing opportunity.
I agree. Thrilled to be
and
here.
And we hear from the Lynn Bushnells and Torlough McConnell, who are very much exponents of, you know, the... not only the huge challenges, but you're a tough lady, and you're going to make this. You're going to make this work.
That's my plan, with a lot of help.
The website, friends, and it is where we have been discussing Ireland's Great Hunger Museum in Hamden, Connecticut, museum on Gortha Moor. The website is IGHM, as in Ireland's Great Hunger Museum, .org. That's not .com, it's not .net, it's not .ie. www.ighm.org. And you are listening to Irish Radio Network, USA.